Well, welcome back to another Comfort Reads episode. This time I am joined by Adrian Ryan from Spectology, who has been nice enough to have me on his podcast several times, and he's guested on mine as well. So thanks for joining me, Adrian.
Yeah, my pleasure. I feel like I'm one of the few return guests on your podcast, and I feel very, like, you know, proud of that.
Yes. I feel like you and I seem to talk a couple times a year on podcasts, and it's awesome.
So. Yeah, no, it's very nice. I like it a lot. And it's always, you know, usually good books. It hasn't been a bad book yet that I can think of.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, we talked about some movies as well, which was a fun episode.
Right. Yeah, those have been fun.
Yeah. So when I put out the feeler for people to come on with the comfort reads, you threw out a lot of ideas over email.
I know.
And some of them I was like, well, okay, I guess I could read some Kierkegaard.
Yeah.
So why don't you tell me about, like, the genre of comfort reading that you like?
Okay, yeah. So I have a, you know, science fiction podcast. That's kind of how we know each other, Spectology.
Right. I guess I should have started there, just in case anybody didn't remember.
Oh, right, right. No, I was just thinking, like, you would think that, like, oh yeah, escapist science fiction, like, plot heavy novels, like, that's going to be, no. My comfort reading tends to be more like kind of like big, dense, or sometimes also small, dense, but nonfiction largely. Like, I don't actually read all that much nonfiction outside of the, and so there's something about it that when I can just, like, sit down with a really big, long book that is, like, hopefully still entertaining to some degree, but also is going to, like, put me into a different world that's somehow actually our world, I find something very comforting and, you know, I don't know if comforting, but definitely relaxing and soothing about that. And so my comfort reads, I would say there's a way, you know, I know a lot of people comfort read also means something they reread over and over again.
Yeah, yeah.
That is sometimes true for me, but not always, right? I feel like a lot of my comfort reads I've read, like, once, maybe all the way through, and then, like, I'll pick up bits and pieces of it, or it's just like, but in a lot of ways it's just more the kind of book that I like. Like, when I'm in, like, I've read too much science fiction, I can't focus, everything's terrible, like, oh, let's pick up some, like, tome and, like, work through it.
Okay.
See how far I get.
I was going to ask that, if it was the kind of thing where it was something that you would read the entire thing, or just, you know, read until it had the desired effect.
Yeah, it really, you know, I like nonfiction partially because it's easier to pick up and put down than, like, a novel is, especially something like the book we're talking about today, Secondhand Time, which is, like, each chapter is kind of a standalone story about, like, a real person and their real experiences. But also, you know, I read plenty of, like, you know, I'd say more academic nonfiction books. I particularly like history books, particularly, like, economic history books are kind of, like, a particular area of mine that I enjoy reading. And those can sometimes themselves be, you know, sometimes, like, there's a certain thing a lot of academic books do, which is they, like, introduce the concepts in a very broad overview in the first chapter. And then the next couple of chapters are a slightly more in-depth overview of the concepts. And then the last half of the book is even more in-depth, like, you know, really specific. And so those kind of books are great because I can get to the point where it's like, okay, I understand it well enough for me. And, like, it's just gotten too specific and academic. And, like, whatever point that is in the book is when I can kind of, like, fade away from it. Sometimes that's the whole book. Sometimes it's the first chapter.
Yeah. I hadn't really considered the idea of nonfiction as comfort reading until you brought it up. And then I started thinking about the kind of nonfiction that I like to read, which is typically, I call it short topic science fiction, or not science fiction, science, short topic science.
Right.
So it's either, like, a brief book on one topic, like a book like Neutrino. I can't remember who wrote that one. Or there was one called Massive by Ian Sample that was all about the hunt for the Higgs boson. Mm-hmm. And so, like, it's a brief popular level science book, or one that's on a variety of topics, but little digestible chapters where I can, like, have it on my nightstand, read a chapter and I'm good for the day. And if I pick it up 6 months later, I haven't lost anything.
100%. 100%. Yeah. No, there's something very, like, you know, I mean, there's something very nice, especially in times like these where attention is, like, difficult to wrangle sometimes, about having something that doesn't require putting a long-term effort into it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting you say that. You would think, like, being at home, it would make it easier, but that hasn't been my experience. Like, it took some time for me to figure out how to carve out the time to take care of myself.
Totally. I mean, and you have like people with you, which makes it even harder. Like, you know, I think especially like being alone, I was like, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to have all this free time. But, you know, like how much of that free time is spent like staring at a wall and like feeling existential dread or something along those lines? Or, you know, staring at Twitter and feeling the same is probably more accurate.
Right. Yeah. Well, Twitter does have that effect sometimes.
So. Yeah, right. Right. And it can sometimes be its own form of like, you know, one of the books I talked about was mentioned potentially doing was Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling. I almost said Fear and Loathing. Yeah. and that is also a book that is like, I mean, right, it's like existential philosophy. It's like, right. You know, really kind of like, you know, hard and difficult and scary and like, you know, kind of like there's full of dread, right? I mean, mm-hmm. even the Fear and Trembling, I think.
Yeah, the title evokes that.
So. Right, exactly. It's not, it wears its heart on its title. but there's something about that, like when I'm feeling particularly shitty or stressed out, where like reading someone else who is like trying to grapple with why it is that you feel shitty and stressed out and like really right. go into kind of this like deep philosophical place with it. You know, not to mention, I find that book very interesting because Kierkegaard is also a Christian. And like, while I am not, I, you know, I grew up as one and, you know, read a lot of this sort of like, you know, come from a tradition that's very much about reading the Bible and like going to sermons and that's about it. There's not like a whole lot of like kind of critical mm-hmm. work around the Bible in the evangelical tradition that I come from. But like doing that kind of critical work, like really asking like not just like what do these stories mean? Like how deep can we go with them and doing kind of like, you know, sort of like philosophical literary analysis on like these Bible stories that I grew up with. I find very like interesting and like kind of calming in a way that, you know,
It's sort of
interesting given like my relationship with it.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that would make an interesting conversation since I'm still a Christian. Mm-hmm. And that would. And I have read some Kierkegaard just because, you know, I took some philosophy classes at Christian universities and you're going to encounter him.
So. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. What else do you encounter in those philosophy courses? I'm curious.
I mean, it depends on, you know, a Christian university doesn't mean that every class like has to have a pound Jesus into you moment, right?
Right.
Calculus is still just calculus. and you know, I was an engineering major, so most of my classes are in the sciences. Oh, okay. We would, like in the two universities that I went to, a lot of the professors, of course, are men of deep faith or women of deep faith, and they would sometimes give like a little devotional, that kind of thing, stuff they'd been thinking about.
Cool.
But no, in the philosophy classes, it tended to be, you know, you'd hear from all the giants of philosophy going all the way back to the Greeks. Mm-hmm. And there would be some Christian philosophers in there as well, but there was no emphasis on that.
Okay, interesting. So. Yeah, I mean, part of me has always kind of like been curious at taking some sort of like Christian philosophy course. I mean, kind of in a similar way that, you know, a lot of universities will have like the one like Eastern philosophy or like Buddhist philosophy course or whatever.
Yeah, it's comparative
kind of like,
religion.
Oh, yeah. Right. And it's sort of like is treated a little bit of like, ooh, what is this weird, strange object? Like, you know, kind of like recontextualizing Christianity in that same way. So it's been kind of an interesting project to me.
I will say that, you know, I'm of course not speaking for like if somebody went to BYU or Liberty University or something, I have no idea what they're going to learn at those. I can only speak for the places that I went. And the other thing is I took a class called Christian Classics, and that was it pulled in people like Augustine and lots of the kind of old saints of the Catholic Church and that kind of stuff, throughout all of that history.
That had to be a really interesting course.
Yeah. That was a really, really good one. And introduced to like guys like Bonhoeffer from, you know, World War II Germany.
Oh, okay. I see.
Yeah. The Confessing Church, the church that was opposing Hitler.
Oh. Okay. Really interesting. I actually never heard that name before. So that's
interesting
guy. Very fascinating, right?
Yeah. He was briefly involved with the plot to assassinate Hitler.
Whoa.
So anywho, why don't we move on to actually talking
killing
about
killing Nazis?
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Kind of. Right.
Yeah. Right.
So why don't you tell me about the title that we did settle on?
Right. So Secondhand Time is a collection, it's like a narrative nonfiction history of the fall of the Soviet Union, written by this woman, Svetlana Alexievich, who has this kind of like form of writing that she does where she does these really deep interviews with people who have lived through extreme events, largely in the Soviet Union and like Russia, because she's Belarusian. She like grew up in the Soviet Union and she's very interested in a lot of Soviet history now that we're in a post-Soviet era. So she will interview people and then she will take those interviews and rewrite them as if they were like just a first person narrative that that person is like telling you. That kind of removes her and her questions from it. So it's kind of like the way that someone might, you know, edit an interview and for TV and like remove the like interviewer and just have like a talking head.
Yeah. You don't have the prompts.
Right, exactly. But you're doing that through this kind of text format, you know, she's writing. And so there's definitely also an element of like, you know, she writes with a particular voice that she gives to a lot of her characters slash the people she's interviewed. So there's some element of like, you know, it's not fiction in the sense of, or it's not literary in the sense that any of it's made up. Like she's taking real stories that people have told her about, but it is literary in the sense that she is like rewriting their stories and giving them like a very literary voice that they can communicate with. And so it's a really interesting project. It means that these stories are just like these beautifully told stories, often of really like difficult material, because it's sort of about the, like, I'd say like the last 20 years of the Soviet Union and the first, like, you know, the kind of end of the Soviet Union. A lot of it focuses on the, like, you know, perestroika and the sort of like final days of the Soviet Union, and then the actual fall and like aftermath and the kind of like, you know, sort of like 5-10 years of like the aftermath of that and people kind of looking back on it. And you get a lot of different opinions and a lot of different people who, you know, you hear from like party cadres who are like high level communist officers. You hear from like, you know, peasants. You hear from people who went to the gulags. You hear from people who sent people to the gulags. You just hear from like everyone across the entirety of Soviet society. And it's a really interesting way of sort of, you know, like I look at it, you know, listening to it. And I'm obviously, so I listen to it mostly on audiobook, which we can talk about a little bit. That's also part of the comfort thing for me, is getting to just listen instead of have to actually read. And also it's a phenomenal audio, but you listen to it, right?
Yeah, it's terrific.
Right. They have a bunch of different actors, so you kind of like get the sense of like each chapter being a new person, and it's very interesting. But there's just something very, you know, it's a fascinating book. It's about a, you know, a society that I really like know nothing about what it's like to live in that society. You know, I've always heard kind of the like, oh, Soviet Union, bad guys. And like, you know, true, it was a, you know, terrible like government in a lot of ways. And it's not particularly like kind to the authoritarianism of the Soviet Union, but it is very, you know, like empathetic to the people like living through that. And that is, I think, a really interesting project.
No, so I'm quite a bit older than you, and so I have vivid memories of the Cold War. I'm trying to think, were you born before like the Berlin Wall fell?
I was born in 86, so just around there. Yeah. Okay.
So you were never really conscious of it.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Whereas like, you know, the Berlin Wall came down when I was a junior in high school, and my German teacher
It was 89, right, when it came down?
Yeah, 89. Okay. And my German teacher was actually from Berlin and had escaped like the night before the wall went up.
Whoa.
And so she was super emotional, and it was, so we had a connection to kind of that period in time. Right. And also, you know, just in schools, like they drummed into you that Russians were the bad guys, right? You had to get a really liberal teacher to go, well, you know, yeah, the Russian system isn't great. The USSR isn't great, but you know, the people in the trenches they're just people like us.
Right.
So yeah, definitely a different experience probably than you had.
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, it was more just like we didn't think about or talk about it all that much.
Yeah.
You know, like the Cold War kind of fit into this awkward element of like, you know, when I was in school, American history kind of like ended just before the Vietnam War began, because it was like, that gets a little bit political, so we don't really want to talk about it. But that means that like, you know, the Cold War wasn't current events, and it also, most of it didn't really fit in like history class. And so it just kind of got glossed over and like kind of like referenced as opposed to talked about.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting that in Secondhand Time, while it does focus kind of on that last 20, 30 years of the Soviet Union, it does reference back to the beginnings of it, right? It references back to Stalin and World War II. And it's
fascinating. A lot of World War II.
Yeah, a lot of it. Yeah. And it's fascinating the different voices, where one person would talk about how she just worshipped Stalin and thought he was the greatest and practically prayed to him. And mm-hmm. that, I mean, I can't say that that kind of cult of personality doesn't happen anymore, obviously. But right. You like to think that we're not going to see that in the United States. But yeah, I'll leave it there.
Right. No, I mean, the stuff about Stalin was really wild because it was this sort of thing of like, I feel like even the people who had that cult of personality around him also would be like, yeah, and things were really terrible, sure.
Yeah.
You know, like everyone kind of admitted like how terrible life was, and like that Stalin was kind of the architect of that, even while there was still this like worship of him. And it was a lot of the sense of like, oh, but things had to be hard. I think too, you know, I made the joke about killing Nazis. I think the World War II thing is also really interesting because so much of the like, you know, identity, you can tell so much of the identity of like the Soviet people is tied around this, like, no one else defeated the Nazis. Like, we defeated the Nazis. Like, they mm-hmm. invaded us and we like took our hits and then we fought them back. And like, we were the ones who like defeated them in the end, which is mm-hmm. like, you know, not wrong. Like, I learned in history class that like, you know, America did D-Day and like we defeated the Nazis, which is like, you know, kind
America
of
was a relief pitcher,
right? Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. Like we definitely like mopped up at the end, but you know, it's not like D-Day happened in France.
Yeah.
It was the Russians who like went into Germany. Mm-hmm. And like that's why the Berlin Wall was in Berlin, because the Russians made it all the way into Berlin and like we didn't.
Right. Yes.
And so I don't know. So I found that very interesting too. Just like, you know, the first time I listened to it being the degree to which like everyone's like, just matter of factly, like, of course, yeah, we won World War II for everyone else. Mm-hmm. And then look at how everyone treated us.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, that's not wrong necessarily actually.
Right.
Even though that's not how I was taught it at all, but I can see that as a point of view.
Yeah. And I mean, they called it the Great Patriotic War, didn't they?
Yeah. I think very frequently they did.
Yeah. There's something that, I mean, you and I growing up in Alaska, you know, there's an Alaskan pride, you know, like, hey, we're tougher than other people because we grew up in Alaska. And there's a lot of that in this book of talking about how great the Soviet people were, how tough they were, how they're the hardiest people in the world. We're tough. We don't need blue jeans. We don't need Pepsi. You know?
Right.
We don't need McDonald's.
Right. We need guns, or we need, you know, missiles or whatever it is at the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious because where I grew up, there are a couple of the like old believer villages like nearby Homer. And I'm wondering if you had any, you know, I don't know how much there are like old believers in Anchorage, if you had any sort of like, you know, relationship with anyone who's an old believer. So I don't know. The listeners might not know. Old believers are like this sect of Russian Orthodoxy that was actually schismatic, and like they left Russia, I think, in like the 1700s or 1800s, something mm-hmm. like that. A lot of them came to the U.S. and settled, including in places like what is now Alaska. And so you get these, you know, fairly sizable villages, some of them like measuring up to even 1,000 people, where people mm-hmm. like still live wear the traditional silk blouses like men do. It's very like traditional. They speak Russian. They have their own schools where they educate their children in Russian. And it's, you know, so like Russian culture actually does exist in Alaska in this particular way.
Yeah. No, in Anchorage, we didn't really encounter a lot of that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, because it was something that I encountered, like, I had, like, a friend, you know, whose name was, like, Mikhail or something like that in mm-hmm. elementary school, who was, like, you know, one of the kids that I would hang out with, and it was definitely something we, like, saw a fair amount of, because, which I always forget the name of the one that was, like, closest to Homer, but there's one that, you know, like, Homer's kind of the end of the road. There's one Russian village that's actually further out, actually on the end of the road from Homer, and that was the one that, like, I knew a couple of, like, kids from. In elementary school. Because after elementary school, they like teach kids like middle school and high school.
Yeah. I remember somewhere down on the Kenai Peninsula area, there was a city called Nikiski.
Yes.
And I think it had one of those.
Yeah. Kind of villages. Nikolaevsk was the one that was close to Nikiski. Yeah. Nikolaevsk is, I think, the largest of the Russian villages. They at least like they had like a real high school, and they even had like sports teams and stuff that we'd like play sometimes. Because I grew up on the Kenai Peninsula, so we would like, you know, play the like Russian village sports team. Yeah, very. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Very interesting. And so I'm wondering now as I'm saying all this, like, oh, I wonder if this is some of the fascination with like Russian culture in particular is the like kind of, you know, I mean, Alaska sure. was owned by the Russians before America. And some, yeah. you know, owned, taken from the natives by the Russians before the yes. Americans came and did the same.
Yeah. So the book is an interesting mix, and she'll juxtapose opinions mm-hmm. from people with diametrically opposed positions, because one of them will be mm-hmm. hearkening, you know, back to how good it was under the Soviet regime, you know, where the trains ran on time and they all had enough food and they had work to do and they had, mm-hmm. they had some meaning in their life. And then, you know, you'll hear somebody else talking about how their father was dragged off to the gulag for no reason. And he was beaten and tortured for 10 years and then came back and was a shell of himself.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's, there's always, I guess what I want to say is this, like, I grew up very politically conservative. Mm-hmm. And I see in this book a lot of the sort of conservative impulse, meaning the impulse to conserve the current, what we currently have.
Right.
And despite the fact that though for you, it seems that everything is great and everything is fine, it's not necessarily that way for everybody. And you're right. kind of taking your experience and just going, well, it's fine for me. So it must be fine for everybody else. And if it's not, it's probably their own fault.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The personal responsibility angle.
Right. I think in particular, there were a couple of, there's one woman I particularly remember who like, you know, tells her story for a while and like, you know, kind of more and more you hear like more and more about, oh, like everyone's complaining now and I don't understand like why we yeah. had it so good. And then like, it comes out that like, oh yeah, she was a party cadre. She like, you know, right. was like very powerful and like thus also very wealthy and like very like well to do within this system. Right. And like yeah. this kind of thing that slowly comes out of like, well, of course it was good for you, right? Yeah. Like you had all the things that meant you didn't have to worry about the things everyone else that, you know,
yeah,
Svetlana Alexievich is like talking to had to worry about. Mm-hmm. But then also you do hear too sometimes from people who like did not have that experience but did say, you know, still had the sense of like, oh, like we really were a people who like came together, right? Like for them right. it's not necessarily the sense of like, oh, we had all the things that we needed, but it was more like, oh, we never had any of the things that we needed, but we had each other, right? Like we had the dacha, right. we had the like communal kitchens, we had like, you know, whatever it was that made us like a Soviet people together. And yeah. those to me are some of the most interesting ones, just because that's not, you know, this idea of like Homo Sovietus or whatever they call it, or like, right. you know, building the Soviet man, which in some ways is this like weird eugenics, you know,
kind yes.
of like, you know, killing a bunch of people so that the only ones left have like the right ideology and the right, like, you know, kind of makeup right. for being communist. But then at the same time, like you also get this sense of like, well, when people go through hard times together, they really do bond in certain ways, you know, mm-hmm. and like it does really feel like, especially in the portion of the book set after the fall of the Soviet Union, you do see the degree to which like that was like terribly mishandled, and in some ways like yeah. what came out of it was like worse for like most people living on the ground.
Right. Yeah, I was going to mention the like the Armenia and Azerbaijani
yep,
conflict exactly. that happened. I mean, immediately as soon as the Soviets rolled out, right?
Right, right.
Where they were keeping everything in order there. They were keeping people happy with each other, and then I mean, not happy with each other, but there was at least a detente, right?
Right, right. Well, and there was a shared identity that went beyond just their national yeah. identity, it sounded like. And then once that got lost, it went straight back to the old, like, sectarian, you know.
Yeah.
Although yeah. you also have to think about the, you know, why was there a shared identity? Well, because the Soviet Union, like, came in and, like, just moved a bunch of people from one yeah. place to, right? Like, along with the good, also, like, that good, air quotes, right. also came with this sort of like forced mass migration and yes. all this other stuff.
Yeah, we're not presenting it as a objective good, right? There's right. context to it.
Right.
But then even stuff like after the breakup, you know, like there's that point where somebody's going back to the Ukraine and they're being advised, don't speak Russian. If you speak Russian, right. then you're going to be in a lot of trouble. You need to speak Ukrainian. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really, really fascinating, because all of a sudden the oppressors are gone. And so now anyone who sounds like the oppressors is assumed to be an oppressor, even right. though they might've just been, you know, a working stiff from Russia.
Right. Exactly.
Who didn't necessarily want to go to Ukraine.
Right, right. And that I mean, that kind of thing was just this really fascinating look into, you know, I mean, to me, a lot of it spoke to like the way that this like breakdown of society was like not managed, yeah, per se. Mm-hmm. Like it just sort of like was let to happen. And, yeah, you know, I also some of the like, I'm trying, because I didn't re-listen to this part, so I'm trying to remember the specifics, but, you know, the sort of like stories of like, oh, afterwards people were given these vouchers to kind of like, you know, like that, like they could then like based on what they had in the old system, they could turn into like money in the new system. And it was just like, right, the way that was just like grossly mishandled, and like, you know, a bunch of people got super rich and everyone else was just left with nothing. And this is, yeah, kind of like, you know, is this sort of irony of like, you know, capitalism doesn't like necessarily per se have to like work out the way that it did, but the, yeah, way that they worked it out was everything that everyone had always told them like capitalism would be when it came.
Right,
right. It was this kind of irony of everyone being like, yeah, look at it, like we got capitalism and look how terrible things got, and exactly the way Stalin told us it would.
Yeah.
Which was like a really kind of, you know, sort of like this, you know, it strikes me a little bit. You know, you see this in politics now too, where people like mismanage something on purpose so that they can say like, look at how terrible this thing is.
Right. I can't think of any examples of that.
Yeah, though. No, I'm, you know, I'm kind of coming up blank on what I could mean by that. but yeah. It's, I don't know. I find it just such an interesting book, and just like a book that is filled with like, okay, this is something that might be like vaguely offensive, and I'm like sorry to everyone for that if it is, but like there's also something about the Soviet Union that is like science fictional to me, right? It's this like, yeah, just very different way of organizing a society. And like, mm-hmm, as someone who has like grown up in America my whole life, and like, you know, even when I've traveled, it has mostly been to other like Western capitalist countries, like this, yeah, idea that there is this like way to organize an entire society that is actually fundamentally different. Like it means, right, that like the thoughts you think are different, and like feelings you feel are different, and like the way you live your life is so fundamentally different. And it's not just because, yes, it's like, oh, it's colder there, that, you know, or it's more rural. Like, yeah, I've lived that. You've lived that, right? Like, yeah, I get that part. But there's also something like, you know, this like whole communist regime is like, there's something fundamentally different about the way people live their life. And like learning about that is really eye-opening, because I feel like so, yeah, often the only way to try to like learn about that is to think about like, oh, what did people in like, you know, the Edwardian like era like feel and think, you know, this sort of like, yeah, historical thing. And being able to do that with people who are otherwise so like us and living, right, in a like world that's so like our, and in fact like talking about things that I have heard talked about from like my angle, and like seeing it literally like, you know, from the other side,
yeah,
is just a really fascinating way of kind of like, you know, I feel like opening up your brain to the world a little bit for good and bad.
Yeah, because like my schooling, we read stuff like Animal Farm and 1984, you know, and so, mm-hmm, I pictured, mm-hmm, the Soviet Union as Oceania, you know, I pictured it 100%. In those totalitarian terms. And I know that some of that was critique of the Soviets in particular, but I don't know, that's something of the brilliance of that 1984 that I feel like it can spray in all directions and get the bad tendencies in every political system and every ideology.
Right.
And you can apply it to that. But
right.
Yeah, it, like I always pictured the Soviet Union kind of in black and white. Everything's gray too. And, yep, you know, my sister went on a multi-country European trip when she was in a gap year after high school. Mm-hmm. And she went to Berlin and, you know, went into West Berlin and went into East Berlin as well. And she did say that, you know, it was like you were stepping out of a place that was in color to a place that was gray, mm-hmm, when you went into East Berlin. And she went to the Soviet Union as well. She went to Moscow.
Oh, wow. So this was while the Soviet Union was still the USSR?
It was, yeah. This was 87. So, oh, wow. This is not long after Chernobyl, really. And she brought back a bottle of Pepsi with her. And I've always wondered, was that thing safe?
Right, yeah. Good question.
Yeah.
Depends on where she bought it, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, probably. So, I mean, what is it about this book, though, that, I mean, we talked about the sort of category of comfort, mm-hmm, reading. Like, is there something particular about this one that kind of makes it fall into that comfort reading category?
Yeah, I think there's a few things. One is the like the fact that it's just like stories really well told. Mm-hmm. Right. And I can definitely just like put on the audiobook version and just like let it kind of wash over me as I like do something else, right? Like maybe I'm cooking or cleaning or you know, just whatever around the house. And it's just like this lovely kind of like set of words about like just some person and their life. And like, you know, the stories are really interesting, but also it's just like really well written and really like well told. And so that is just very nice, especially when I'm having a hard time. Like I often think of comfort reads as like stuff I can read when I'm having a hard time paying attention to anything, you know, when my anxiety is kicking up. And so like that's letting something just wash over me really works for that. And then I think that maybe the other piece of it is there, you know, there's a sense of like everyone in the book went through really hard times.
Yeah.
No one in the book like had an easy life, even the like richest, like most powerful people, like no one had an easy life. And there's something weirdly comforting about that, not in the like sense of like, oh, well, other people have had it worse than me. So that's, but like, oh, even when things are hard, even when times are tough, like people still have lives.
Yeah. Right?
Like people still like make lives for themselves and still like, you know, like, like fall in love and like, you know, have good and bad days and like, you know, like, you know, make friends and make enemies and just like life still goes on. And there's something, you know, comforting about that in particular. But like life continues even as life is hard.
Though I feel like we should caution people that not all the stories are happy. You know, some of them are
terrifically
sad.
A lot of them are not happy. There's also, it should be, you know, I don't know, like, you know, kind of content warning. There is a fair amount of anti-Semitism in particular, like espoused by the people in the book. And that is something that, you know, you can tell some people have a really complicated relationship with it. You know, there's also stories of like people like, you know, trying to protect Jews in their village when the Nazis come through and stuff. Right. There's also a lot of like anti-Semitic kind of like thought, as well as like a couple of slurs used like at a few points in the book. And you can tell it's a really like, I don't know, that was sometimes like hard to listen to. How upfront people.
Yeah. And there's even just sort of the standard xenophobia. You know,
a lot of that, right?
Of, you know, hey, Russia should be for Russians, you know, and not for other people. Even though, of course, Russia is such a massive country that you can't expect everybody to look the same.
Right, exactly.
And yet some of them seem to.
Yeah, no, there's definitely some, you know, but that's part of what is like, you know, it's like people are given the chance to fully express themselves, like for good or bad, right? And like, I think that is something that I find like, you know, I find really fascinating. There's another book called The Corpse Walkers that does kind of the same thing, but for like rural China. And it's all like, it's kind of a guy who does like a very similar project of like, he goes around rural China and he just like interviews people and then rewrites those interviews as like stories they've told him. And it's just so wild to like read these stories of just like, you know, what it's like to live like in the most rural, most poor parts of China in like the 70s and 80s and 90s. And there's something about these kind of books that I find really like, you know, there's a lot of humanity to them. Humanity isn't always a good thing per se, but like there's something like really like kind of life affirming about them, even while they're like awful. And also then there's some of the stories that are like really beautiful and gorgeous too.
Yeah. Good
and
stuff.
And I think, too, the fact that it's audio and I can just listen to it, you know, it's like I have a hard time usually listening to audiobooks. This is one that just like clicked for me the like moment I started listening to it. Actually, no, the first chapter was kind of hard to listen to because it's the most like written of the chapters, because it's like Alexievich talking about like what she's going to do in the rest of the book. After that first chapter, it like really just like clicked immediately for me.
Yeah, it was definitely an easy one to just keep listening to. And it's a massive book, too. So it was something like 19 hours on audio or something like that. So, or
14. Yeah. Right. I think 14, 15, something like that. It's definitely, it's a big one. I have bigger ones. I you know, she's written a couple of different books. So her book about Chernobyl was one of the like main source books for the Chernobyl TV show, is my understanding. Oh. Like she has a book about Chernobyl that is just like the exact same project and like her telling stories about like telling the stories of people who lived through Chernobyl. And she has another one that's explicitly about like everyone she interviews in that was a woman who fought in World War II. So it's called The Womanly Face of War. And it's about like Soviet women fighters, like actual combat fighters in World War II. And so I like have both of those on my to read list because like this was so good, and it's just two other like totally fascinating like eras of history and kind of points of view on history.
Definitely. Well, I was going to ask if you had any comps for it, but it sounds like that one that you were talking about rural China is
a- yeah, the Corpse Walkers. I think that's what it's called. It's like the Corpse Walker or Corpse Walkers, something like that. I don't remember the name of the author off the top of my head, but that is a very good one, and that is that's actually a like he writes a bunch of these stories. That's like one that's sort of like a collection of translated stories. It's less of a like through line like this book is, because this book very much has like beginning, middle, and end, and like kind of a like narrative to it. That slightly less so. It's more of a collection of stories. And then I'm trying to think. I feel like, you know, there's also, you know, science fiction podcasts. There's also some like really cool Soviet science fiction out there. Mm. I used to have this just like giant book full of like short stories written in like Soviet Russia. I don't anymore, and I don't remember the name of it. But one novel I have read is the it's called the Andromeda Galaxy. Mm. And then also the Strugatsky brothers are also like relatively well known. They wrote like Roadside Picnic, which got turned into like the Stalker movie and video games, and a few other like well known books. And so, you know, there's like a whole world also of just like communist science, right? There are like Cuban science fiction authors, there are like science fiction authors from like around the communist world, and I find reading that science fiction to be really fascinating too for a lot of the same reasons, so worth picking up. I think Yoss is the Cuban guy I've read.
Well, I think we can wrap it up there.
Sounds good. Well, how did you like the book, actually? I'm just very curious, like.
Yeah, I thought it was terrific. And okay, it's one of those ones that I think reread or re-experiencing it would be valuable just because there's so much to it. And some of the stories are so tragic, and some of them are, you know, very short as well. And so it's easy. Like, I was trying to write down what was in this book. And there's a few things that stuck out to me. There was the suicide of the 14-year-old kid that just broke my heart. And so, yeah, it's one that I would like to revisit. I might enjoy this in print, actually, just because then I could kind of go through it more at my own pace. And there's times that I would probably want to set it down. And with audio, it's a little easier to just move on, right?
Right. No, I hear what you're saying. Yeah. Totally.
But no, it was really good. A good experience. So I want to thank you for recommending it. And you actually brought this one up on our Left Hand of Darkness episode.
I probably did. Right. I mean, like Land of Forever Winter and the gulags and Left Hand of Darkness. So that I'm sure I did.
Yeah.
As well as I guess that story does the whole, like, you know, like kind of like just every other chapter is just like a story that someone told Genli I. And so there's kind of that piece of it too. Interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, before we sign off, where can people find you?
Oh, yeah. You know, spectology.com is the podcast. I'm also spectologypod at Gmail or spectologypod on Twitter. I tweet more than I should, so if you like bad Twitter content, go there. And I don't know. That's mostly it. You know, I have like a personal Facebook, but I don't do like, you know, online stuff there. I'm more local on Facebook, which is nice.
Now, Spectology, for anybody who's gotten this far and hasn't ever listened to it, you typically have a pre-read and a post-read on a relatively recent science fiction book.
Yeah, we focus more on, I'd say, science fiction largely of the last, like, you know, of the like 21st century, I guess, like the last 20 years mostly. Some older ones, we did the Left Hand of Darkness, or not, sorry, not the Childhood's End, which I think is the oldest novel we've done to date. But we tend to do like more contemporary science fiction. We do like, it's a book club, so we go really in depth on the books individually, and over two episodes. So if you haven't heard of or read a book before, you can listen to our pre-read and get a sense of if you want to read it or not, and then listen to us go, you know, real deep off the deep end in terms of like, you know, like talking about themes and analysis and stuff in the second episode.
And then you've been doing some other stuff as well, the digital book tour.
Yeah,
and other stuff in your feed, right?
I have a friend B who's been, it's mostly them doing the digital book tour. They're doing these interviews of science fiction authors. Again, mostly like new authors who are either publishing a first or second book. Also some like authors of color, queer authors, like folks who, especially during the first part of COVID, I think we were trying to focus on folks who are having a really hard time with new book releases. Now we have, I think we're a little bit trying to figure out like, what do we want this to turn into? We both really like it. And I really like having B on the podcast. So we have a couple more in the bag that are going to be coming out. And we're also looking at maybe expanding that as well, because that's been a really fun project for the two of us to work on. Yeah.
All right. Well, Adrian, thank you so much for doing this. Really appreciate it. And being an early volunteer.
Yeah, my pleasure. I, you know, will always come and talk for too long on someone else's podcast. It's great when I don't have to edit them, you know?
Exactly. It is nice to be in that chair.
Right. Yeah, so. Thank you for having me on. This is always like a real pleasure to chat with you, Seth.
It's always great to talk to you. You and Matt, I consider you guys friends. We've interacted enough. And I love talking to you guys. So
100%. Well, stay good and healthy through, you know... these times, as they say.
Yes. All right. Sounds good, man. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Adrian. He's always an interesting person to talk to. I always really like talking to him, talking to Matt. If you have not checked out Spectology, I think you'd definitely enjoy it if you're a science fiction fan and you want to interact with some newer books. Then they're definitely a good place to go. And Adrian does some guest spots as well. He did a really cool one with Reading the End recently, talking about the Hugo Awards this year. I haven't really done anything on that because I feel like other people covered it better than I did, better than I could. The Hugo Girl podcast, they did a great episode on it. And then the one with Adrian and Jenny was really, really good. So I'll put links to those in the show notes, and make sure to check them out. So I hope you're enjoying this series. I was talking with Adrian afterwards and just talking about how there's enough negative stuff going on right now. And so the focus of this podcast is I'm trying to shine a light on positive things. And you know, a book like Secondhand Time isn't entirely positive all the time, but it's something that's good for a friend of mine and it might be good for you. And so, yeah, I hope you take some good out of this podcast. All right, that'll do it for this time. And I'll be back with a regular episode relatively soon. Thanks. Bye.